Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
That and I haven't even said anything yet. I'm scared to talk. I'll mess it up now. I would like to thank, it is Professor Jenkins, is it not? Yeah, Professor Jenkins and President Belcher for that warm introduction. I would like to thank you for that warm welcome. You will forgive me, but ever since the election in November, every time I come and travel in the South, I feel obligated to do this. Welcome. I come from the blue states. I come in peace. I bring you greetings from my people. Okay. Now, I don't know. Maybe you're wondering how, you know, I could ever have gotten the idea that, you know, one country had become two nations. I guess the short answer is that I spend entirely too much time reading the newspaper, and in particular reading people who do what I do for a living, reading commentators. So that's what I wanted to talk with you about tonight here. I was I'm told that this is a week of journalism, is that correct? And I wanted to talk with you about this this field, this profession, and this privilege that I have had the honor of engaging in for the last 29 years. Let me begin here. It is probably a sign that I have entirely too much time on my hands, but lately I find myself pondering what kind of column Ann Coulter would write if George Bush was caught smoking crack in the Oval Office. Now work with me here. I mean, if the president has ever done anything that Ann Coulter didn't like, I have not read it. So I just find myself wondering what she would do with the story of W on crack. I like to think that even she would write a passionate essay of disgust and disappointment. But then I also like to think that this will be the year that Halle Berry finally realizes that she and I were meant to be. So as much as I like to think that, I suspect that the column that Ann Coulter would write would express passionate disgust and anger only for whatever crack-dealing, scum-sucking liberal got the president hooked on crack in the first place. Now, let me be fair. On the other hand, it is also fun to speculate what sort of column Michael Moore would turn in if somehow Bush managed to bring peace to the Middle East and personally capture, I see him out there in combat fatigues, personally capture Osama bin Laden in the same afternoon. I see from Michael Moore a lead that says something to the effect of, in a move to secure drilling rights for his Texas oil cronies, and, you know, kind of goes downhill from there. Welcome to the wonderful world of punditry. Please check your logic at the door. Have you noticed in reading people who do what I do for a living that facts don't really matter that much anymore? Or have you noticed more to the point how we don't all seem to even have the same facts anymore? It used to be that all of our arguments sprang from a common body of information that we called the truth. You might place the emphasis in a different place than I would. You might interpret this information in a way that I did not, but at the end of the day, we were both operating from the same set of facts, non-negotiable, concrete information assembled for us by reporters, vetted for us by editors, both of whom were presumed to be, or at least to behave like, disinterested observers. But the times, as Dylan once famously observed, they have changed. Now you get to choose your facts as you do items from an all-you-can-eat buffet. Facts that are facts, in quotes, that are supplied to you by party partisans masquerading as reporters, internet activists out to prove their theses, conspiracy theorists with multiple axes to grind, vanity press authors, and all of it vetted by nobody in particular and treated by many readers yet as if it is equal to or indeed superior to the information that comes to us by more traditional means. Worse, our newsrooms, our opinion pages, and our television debate shows have seen a creeping infestation of commentators for whom facts are just as subjective, men and women for whom the mission statement is not to move hearts and minds, but to win the argument, which is not necessarily the same thing. Increasingly, they are not out to persuade, but to pound, to beat the other side into silence by any means necessary. You can call it smash mouth commentary. You can call it crossfire commentary. Whatever you call it, just know it for what it is. It's the news media's short-term panacea for the fact that a lot of you folks seem to be getting along just fine without us. But it is also a long-term threat to the credibility of our opinion pages and televised debate, and essentially a long-term threat to our ability to keep any of you still watching or listening to us. And it is a disservice and a betrayal of you, our audience, who come to us, those folks who come to us seeking thoughtful analysis of the great issues and conflicts of the day. Now, this trend that I'm speaking of is more conservative than it is liberal, but make no mistake about it, the folks on the left side of the political spectrum are rapidly catching up to the folks on the right side of the political spectrum in their ability to misuse facts, to make simplistic arguments, and to bash the other side with no real interest in or attempt at persuasion. I always thought that the reason that we have an argument is so that I can persuade you or that you can persuade me. But increasingly, the reason that we have arguments is so that I can shut you up. And again, there's a difference. I use Michael Moore and Ann Coulter as my poster boy and poster girl because they have the distinction, I don't know if you're familiar with this, they have the distinction of having both caused controversy when they were hired last year, I guess it was, by USA Today to provide commentary of the Democratic and the Republican conventions. Moore was dangled before convention delegates like a sirloin before hungry lions. I don't know if you remember seeing, I don't know if you saw any of the news coverage of him walking down the hallway in the convention arena and basically just had a pack of journalists and Republicans who were really not happy to see him there following him down the hall. And the guy from USA Today said, apparently with a straight face, we thought that he would be able to just unobtrusively cover the convention and provide his perspective on it. No stunt us. What do you? No way. The low point, I guess, or the high point, I guess, if you're USA Today, came when Moore was attacked from the podium by Senator John McCain. As the crowd was chanting, four more years, Moore, whose crystal ball was obviously malfunctioning, responded with a counter chant of two more months. Again, his crystal ball was cracked that day. Meantime, Ann Coulter, renowned as always for her subtle wit and restrained analysis, got herself fired by the paper when she turned in a column describing women at the Democratic convention. She described Democratic women as, quote, the corn-fed, no makeup, natural fiber, no bra needing, sandal wearing, hirsute, somewhat fragrant, hippie chick pie wagons, they call women at the Democratic National Convention. Yeah. Yeah. And USA Today again was shocked, simply shocked, that Ann Coulter said something nasty. Ann Coulter was mean? Who'd have thought? So watching this circus, and that's what it was, watching Michael Moore in the hallways at the Republican convention, watching Ann Coulter turn nasty and get herself fired, I found myself wondering what, if anything, this had to do with, the debate over the privatization of Social Security, the invasion of Iraq, the failure of our schools, the environment, race relations, affirmative action, any of the great issues that stand before us. I also wondered how these two individuals ever got page space in USA Today, and what thoughtful or enlightening commentator had to be passed over in order to make room for them. Now, I should point out that there is not anything unique about what USA Today did. As Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz recently pointed out, op-ed pages and TV news programs have become a convenient pit stop for between gigs lobbyists, political strategists, and hacks. But anybody who really thinks that you're going to get thoughtful and even-handed analysis from Pat Buchanan, James Carville, Mary Matlin, or the Reverend Al Sharpton, please see me when I come down from the podium. I've got some riverfront property in beautiful downtown Baghdad that I would like to sell to you. To put it another way, what you will get from those people is star power and fireworks, and increasingly that's what we in media are selling to you, star power and fireworks, and all that it costs us is another teeny tiny piece of who and what it is that we are supposed to be. There used to be this business, maybe you remember it, some of you who have a little bit of more salt than pepper in your hair, this business we called journalism. It was peopled by reporters whose job it was to ferret out information of importance and interest and then to report it, hence the name reporters. Then there were editors who were tasked with making sure the grammar was correct, the storytelling was clear, the facts were facts, and the story was balanced and fair. Finally, there were commentators, folks like me, professional reactors, one person calls them. Our job was to put the news into perspective, to offer analysis and commentary. If a commentator had a bias, that was fine. Who doesn't have a bias in this life? You really didn't mind so long as they could back what they said with facts and with logic, and you had a sense that they were playing fair. So long as they were clearly working for the readers and not for some special interest group or political party. Things are different in what is left of the business of journalism now. Too many of the reporters have been caught lying and plagiarizing. Too many of the editors, I'm here to tell you, spend entirely too much time in meetings and not enough time in editing our copy and making sure that the job we do is the job that we were sent out to do. And too many of the commentators are shilling for political parties instead of commentating, and sometimes getting quite wealthy doing it. How much would you pay for a used pundit? The Bush administration paid almost $250,000. And what did Armstrong Williams, who's the columnist whose work appeared in 50 American newspapers, say when he was caught with his fingers in the cookie jar? He said he had never realized that he was part of this quote-unquote media elite. He had never really thought of himself as a journalist. He's writing a column that appears in 50 newspapers. He never thought of himself as a journalist. One might reasonably wonder then what he was doing working as one. What are Patrick Buchanan, Paul Begala, Oliver North, and James Carville doing anchoring what are ostensibly public affairs news programs? What are Ann Coulter and Michael Moore doing drawing paychecks from USA Today? Why aren't news media's red flags waved by pundits with axes to grind or, conversely, with cozy relationships with a given political administration? Why don't we at least require some degree of separation, the passage of some amount of time, before we give these folks access to the public podium? And one final question, why are you, our customers, our readers, not holding us accountable, not demanding more from us than what we are giving? In the face of our failure to act, and in the face of public apathy, the current administration is frankly getting away with murder. And I'm not simply talking about what it is doing in terms of political its policies and the war in Iraq. I'm talking about the way that it is propagandizing this country to a degree that would have been unthinkable even 4 years ago. You may or may not be aware of this story. It has not gotten a whole lot of news or seemed to catch a lot of traction with people with the public. But the latest scandal, and there are many, you need a scorecard to keep up with them, the latest scandal regarding the administration and the news, it turns out that the Bush administration, in apparent violation of the law, there's a law which says that you may not use the public's money to propagandize the public, has been sending out quote-unquote news reports, videotaped news reports, to local news stations, which are then running them as though they were news. There's no disclaimer, there's nothing that says this came from the government. All you have is somebody standing up portraying a reporter and reporting on some aspect of Bush administration policy. I bet you they're saying nice things. And you don't know that this is the government telling it to you. You don't know that this is the government telling it to you. That we ought to be outraged. We ought to be up in arms. And yet there is, from most of us, silence. There is from most of us silence. And here's the thing. I talked a moment ago about we have our separate facts. If we reach a point where we don't know what we know, maybe we interpret it differently, but if we don't know what we know, if we can't trust what it is that we think we know, then you cannot make an informed decision. You cannot be an informed electorate. It will come as news to no one in this room, I assume, that this business, what's left of the business of journalism, is in trouble, or that public opinion surveys from folks like you repeatedly indicate that you don't hold us in very high esteem. The bad news is that you think less of us than you do of lawyers and used car salesmen, and I apologize to any lawyers and used car salesmen in the room. The good news is that you still think slightly more of us than you do of scum-sucking liberal crack dealers. And I apologize to any scum-sucking liberal crack dealers who are in the room. But my point in saying that it is a sad state of affairs for an industry that was once held in such high esteem for its crusading commitment to justice and truth to come to this point where the people that we purport to serve simply do not trust us. For me, one of the most telling aspects of the Jason Blair scandal wasn't the fact that he was able to lie with impunity without being caught. It wasn't the argument over whether racial politics played a part in his hiring or in his retention. For me, one of the most telling aspects of the Blair scandal was the fact that when the people he had written about, the people that he had victimized by his deceptions, when they were asked, why didn't you complain? You read this story and you saw that this guy was saying things that you never said and putting words in your mouth you never said and basically lying on you, why did you not complain? The people tended to shrug and say something to the effect of they thought that's just the way it's done in media. Okay? Your distrust of us is deep and profound. And I tell people in my business all the time that we make a fundamental mistake if we fail to understand that. Let me tell you a story by way of illustration of all of this. 4 years ago, I wrote this column. It was on the occasion of a survey which indicated that a huge number of readers believe that news media routinely get the facts wrong. I decided I was going to have a little bit of fun with that. So I wrote a column which said, in part, it was, as everyone knows, Bob Hope who griped that he didn't get no respect. Who among us doesn't have fond memories of Bob tugging his tie and bugging his eyes as he delivered that signature line when he hosted the Tonight Show back in the 60s. It was always good for a laugh. One time, Bob's bandleader, Quincy Jones, nearly fell off his stool. I invoke that famous lament because it sums up my response to a new survey from the Pew Center, from the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. It turns out that nearly half of all Americans believe, are you ready for this, that news media routinely get the facts wrong. Walter Cronkite would be appalled to know his profession is held in such low esteem, if he were still alive, that is. And the column sort of went on in that vein. Now, in writing this, I figured that the mistakes were so far over the top that no one could possibly fail to understand that this was satire. Several hundred emails later, I stood corrected. Now, if I were to sum up all of those emails into one, it would read something like this. Pitts, you idiot. Everybody knows it wasn't Bob Hope who didn't get no respect. I'm almost certain it was Rodney Dangerfield. And in any event, neither one of them ever hosted The Tonight Show. You tried to defend the media, but you only ended up proving the point. Why don't you check your information before you print it? You people can't get anything right. Okay. So many people misunderstood my intention that I wrote a follow-up column. No satire this time. I've learned my lesson. I played this one perfectly straight. This column said in part, very chastised tone of voice here, last week, I wrote about a study that indicated many people consider the news media prone to factual errors. My column presented a tongue-in-cheek, wholly facetious defense of media, which was, of course, rife with factual errors. My mistakes were, it seemed to me, so obvious and outlandish, no one could possibly take them seriously. But I was, well, mistaken, as evidenced by the hundreds of folks who have since written or called to correct my errors. So, for the record, yes, I'm aware, Bob Hope did not become famous for saying, I don't get no respect. That was Rodney Dangerfield. It's also untrue that Hope was ever the host of The Tonight Show or that Quincy Jones was ever the band leader there, and Walter Cronkite remains very much alive as of this writing. So I'm figuring, okay, I've explained myself now. Everybody gets my point. Everything's hunky-dory, right? I get this email. Guy says, yeah, nice try at covering your ass. You just couldn't admit you made a mistake, could you? So much for the benefit of the doubt. Now, there is, of course, no shortage of reasons that people tend to hold our industry, this industry, in such low esteem. There's that whole inaccuracy and dishonesty thing, that problem which was exacerbated in recent years, not only by Jason Blair, but by Stephen Glass, Jack Kelly, and others. Then there's the issue of bias, although frankly, from where I sit, the fact that both liberals and conservatives both level that accusation suggests to me that I should, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Most people, I have found, tend to define bias as anything that makes my guy look bad. What else do our readers dislike? Well, some probably think we're arrogant, as demonstrated by the smug way that we discount their claims of bias. Then, for some people, there's the plain fact that they are just, and I'm going to indict you guys here, not you guys, but you guys, big picture, they're just not interested in any news that does not involve, Brad and Jen, or Nick and Jessica, or Kobe and the Kobe accuser, or Kobe and Shaq, as of last year. As long as I'm talking about the reasons that some people don't like the business that I'm in, let me talk about some of the things that I don't like about this business. Sometimes I think that people who do what I do for a living, we forget our mission statement, which is to ferret out the news, make sure the story is balanced, provide commentary and analysis. In print journalism's rush to correct a slide in readership, in its rush to get people like you back, I sometimes wonder if we are not becoming television, quick, bright, and utterly superficial. Where commentary is concerned, I wonder if we are not seeking heat at the expense of light. substituting star power for considered reasoning and pretending that the willingness to shout an outrageous thing at the top of your lungs is the same thing as arguing an opinion. I'll tell you something. Out of all the compliments that I ever get for the work that I do, out of all the people that say, Mr. Pitts, I agree with what you said, or Mr. Pitts, I love the way you write, the one that means the most to me, the one that stays with me the longest, is simply this. Mr. Pitts, I could not predict what you were going to say. Mr. Pitts, you changed my mind. Mr. Pitts, you made me think. Most of us don't like to think, I will grant. Most of us, I think, get a headache if you try to push our reasoning, you know, deeper than the bumper stickers and the talking points. Many of us believe what we want to believe, and reasoning has nothing to do with it. By way of illustration, I offer you a study that was done by Drew Weston, who is professor of psychology at Emory University. Dr. Weston set out to prove how and why people form and hold their opinions. I wrote about this in a column in January and December, actually. Some of you may have read it. He set up the scenario in which the test subjects were led to believe that a soldier was accused of torturing people at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The fictional soldier's defense was that he was following orders from superiors who told him the Geneva Convention had been suspended. Don't worry about it. Do what you've got to do. To defend himself against these charges, this soldier supposedly sought the right to subpoena President Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The question that test subjects were asked to answer is whether he should be given that right. Now, some of the subjects were given very strong evidence. They were given memos and letters and all sorts of evidence indicating that the soldier had indeed been told not to worry about the Geneva Conventions. Other test subjects were given only his word. They had only his word to go on. Here's the intriguing part. The strength or the weakness of the evidence did not matter. Weston was able to predict how people would react over 80% of the time based simply on their opinions of the Bush administration, their opinions of the Republican Party, their opinion of the military, and their opinion of human rights groups. Those who had little affection for the president, those who did not like the Republicans, those who hated the war, they tended to side with this soldier even when the evidence was weak. The folks who supported the president, who support the party, who supported the war, and who hated human rights groups, they tended to side with the president even when the evidence that the soldier was telling the truth was overwhelming. As one of my colleagues at Knight Ritter puts it, people these days, as I said when I talked about facts, we seem to embrace separate truths that reflect no objective reality except our political affiliation. And we seem to be hostile to anything that threatens that affiliation. We seem to resist it even to the point of embracing obvious untruths. My colleague calls it, he says, we are, as a nation, living in alternate realities. I agree. Increasingly, we are a bipolar nation. And, you know, I can understand why, if I was an editor watching my readership sink like a snowbank in the sun, I might try to provide something on my pages for the people who live in those dueling realities. I get this, but enough already. Because, see, if some of us out there don't like to think, there are still a few of us who do. There are still a few of us, I suspect some in this room, who grew up with newspapers and who relish the ability that newspapers, unique among media, have to bring to the breakfast table quality thinkers and quality thinking to help us understand the world, to give us perspectives we might not otherwise have to consider. As a reader, myself, I've been reading newspapers since I was 11 years old. I'm looking for columnists that I feel like complimenting in the same way some of those readers compliment me. And those columnists are actually out there. I tend to read George Will, Richard Cohen, Charles Krauthammer, and Kathleen Parker, not because I always agree with them, but because they always make me think. I don't think George Will and I could agree that I'm standing in Georgia right now. Okay? But George Will seldom fails to make me think. When I look at his stuff, when I look at Kathleen Parker's stuff and some of the others, I can see an intellect at work. They force me to put in the work that is required for me to earn my right to disagree, if indeed I can find a reason to disagree. As I tell the students in my opinion writing classes, if you cannot counter an opposing argument, if somebody comes up with an argument in opposition to something that you have said, you are morally obligated to concede that maybe that person has a point, and they might, heaven forbid, God help us all, they might even be right. But we seem to be so invested in our opinions these days that it is impossible for us to even concede that, impossible for us to even give the other side, whoever it is that's on the other side, to give them even a listen. The kind of mental elasticity that it requires to judge somebody else's argument against your own is a good thing. That sort of intellectual thrust in Perry is what I do, is what commentary is at its very best. Not to put a fine point, too fine a point on it, but commentary is increasingly not found at its best on the pages of your daily newspapers. When a Mona Charon, she's a columnist for those of you who have been lucky enough not to have ever read her. When a Mona Charon can say blithely, "I am for censorship," or when she can suggest, this is after the September 11th attack, when she can suggest that the way to handle it is that all Muslims should be deported en masse, I'm not required to think. I don't have to put in any brain work to say that's the most half-baked, asinine piece of reasoning, if you want to call it that, that I've ever heard. When Michelle Malkin, another columnist, suggests that maybe the internment of Americans of Japanese ancestry during the Second World War was a good thing, I don't have any need for intellectual thrust and parry. She makes news with this because Michelle Malkin is an American of, I'm not sure if it's Japanese heritage, but definitely of Asian heritage. And that's like the oldest trick in the book in terms of getting the attention of the electorate, or getting the attention of the readership. Say the outrageous thing. I could do the same thing. All I'd have to do is write a column and say, you know, that slavery thing wasn't so bad. And I guarantee you'd think I was crazy, but you'd read me. You'd read me. It's an old and stupid trick. When Ann Coulter defames Democratic women, when she says that liberalism is treason, when she calls Helen Thomas an old Arab, I'm not encouraged to think. I'm not enlightened. Let me make a confession here. Once upon a time, I considered myself a political liberal. It was a rather easy decision to make, actually, given the fact that I grew up in an era where conservatives were defined by their opposition to black voting and civil rights and their tendency to keep pining for good old days that some of us did not remember. What was worse, the actor who went on to become their most celebrated president opened his campaign for the presidency by going to the place where three civil rights workers were murdered and announcing, "I support states' rights." If that was conservative, then I was liberal by default. But the funny thing is, as the years passed, I found that I had a little common ground with the folks on the right. They preached personal responsibility, and I found that line of reasoning persuasive. They preached small government, and I found myself agreeing that indeed it is a fallacy to think that everything that ails us can be cured by some government program. They preached the importance of fathers, and although I admit that I had some fun at Dan Quayle's expense, I eventually came around to a belief that, yes, many of the problems that beset our communities, and in particular our communities of color, do have their roots in the simple fact that we have devalued fathers and fatherhood. As a matter of fact, that book over there, which I hope you will buy because I got kids to put through school, is about the issue of fatherhood and the devaluation of fatherhood. So when I sat down for the first time with the folks who were syndicating my column, and they were asking how they should position it and what they should say to the editors when they went in to sell this column, and was I liberal or conservative, my honest answer was yes. Are you liberal or are you conservative? Yes. Because, you see, I felt drawn by both. I wanted to retain for myself the freedom to champion what makes sense and to condemn what does not make sense without regard to what side of the political spectrum it originated on. And because also it seemed to me that the goal of this opinion writing thing is, or at least ought to be, to make some sense, not to score points for my side. I say all of that to say that lately I feel the ground shifting beneath me. Now, as far as I know, I have not changed. But I get this sense that the goalposts have been moved, that people have left the field of common cause in order to hunker down in their bunkers of red and blue extremism. If you ain't with us, partner, you're against us. I increasingly get that sense from self-described liberals, but again, it is much worse from self-described conservatives, many of whom seem to operate under the philosophy that you must drink all of the Kool-Aid or you can't have any at all. I'm thinking about the people for whom, I get emails from these folks all the time, the people for whom referring to the opposing party as the dumb old craps seems to represent the height of wit. People like this will tolerate none of that yes, but stuff. They don't want to hear any of that, well, I agree with you there, but I question that other thing stuff. My days are filled with accusations from people like that. Lots of you liberals this and you liberals that. I'm still trying to figure out whether they are the media's creation or whether they are our punishment. Maybe a little bit of both. It finally occurred to me the other day that liberal has become not just a curse word, but a weird sort of racial proxy. Now, I don't mean when I say that, that people who don't like liberals are racist, but rather that the word liberal is used in much the same way that some of the harsher racial epithets were used once upon a time. It has become, in other words, liberal has become seen not just as a political philosophy, but as an emblem of perceived flaws so deep as to be congenital. You're born a liberal, and impervious to be changed. Liberal has become a race. The L word is the new N word. Now, if you look at it, there is an absolute similarity between the way that liberals and certain marginalized racial groups are thought of by those who do not like them. We are told, I got the emails to back this up, liberals are lazy, they are none too smart, they are dishonest. We know from Ann Coulter that they're not particularly clean and they're disloyal to their country, and that they've also never contributed a worthwhile thing to the country. And in a paradox black people and Jews will surely recognize, liberals are also usually depicted as scheming incompetence against whom conservatives must nevertheless be on guard, because otherwise they're going to take over the whole country. Now again, if you think I'm exaggerating all of this, let me share with you an email I received a few weeks ago. I wrote a column about that was critical of social conservatives, and a lady wrote to accuse me of racism. Not of being wrong, but of being racist. I felt obligated to send the lady a note saying that as far as I know, Republican is not yet a race. And here, let me remind you of something that you probably already know. For all of the talk of a morality divide in this country, the fact is that the divisions between us are not quite as dramatic as they are sometimes portrayed. Take abortion, probably one of the most hot-button issues in this country. 80% of us favor the legalization of abortion. 66% of us support capital punishment. And then let's talk about Hollywood. Because we are told that Hollywood is the major architect of the values divide. Hollywood is a force so corrupting that most of the people in the Bible Belt can't stomach its product. They can't make themselves go to the multiplex. It's too horrible. Take it away, take it away. And I look at this and I wonder how this squares with the fact that last week alone, the movie industry took in $115 million. Now, let's analyze that figure for a moment. Let's consider that last week was not a particularly big week, okay? We're not even into the summer, which is the season of all the summer blockbusters. Spider-Man alone had an opening weekend of $114 million about 3 years ago. But even using that paltry, tiny, little $115 million figure, that works out to just shy of $6 billion annually, which is pocket change, actually, compared to the $11.2 billion that the music industry takes in every year. Now, maybe it's just me, but are you going to tell me that Chicago, New York, and L.A. alone account for all of that windfall? I'm sorry, but I have to believe there's a little Oklahoma City in there. a little Birmingham, Alabama, a little Jackson, Mississippi, maybe even a little Atlanta, GA. So the Hollywood value, the whole Hollywood divide seems to me a little bit overstated. I am not saying that we do not have divisions in our country. Of course we do. What I am saying is that we have more in common than you think from what you read in news media. Nor am I saying that commentary, people who do the work that I do, should always be polite and should never throw elbows. Of course it should throw elbows. I don't know, frankly, what I would do without hypocrites to beat up on. What I am saying is please hold us accountable, because me, for one, and I hope you as readers, I am sick of pundits, commentators, who preach only to their respective choirs. I'm sick of politicians, for that matter, who preach only to their respective choirs, who look for nothing more than approval from their respective amen corners. Screaming in an echo chamber is what it has been called. You deserve more than that. And people in my business, we should be willing to provide and indeed eager to provide it. Doing this job that I do, having this podium from which to add your voice to the national dialogue, make no mistake about it, this is a privilege. This is a privilege that I have. People, I tell people all the time, we all have opinions. I get paid for mine. Can you believe that? They have a job where you get paid for your opinion. Okay, so this is a privilege. Moreover, having this job confers upon those of us who do this job an inordinate amount of power to shape the nation's opinions and its perspectives. And as we all know, or as we should know, if we were part of that $114 million to go see Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility, including the responsibility to never be less than intellectually honest. I don't know about you, but I enjoy when somebody grapples with me on an intellectual basis. You know, let's have at it. May the best argument win. We all have our biases and we all have our preconceptions, but we also have minds. Minds that are waiting to be engaged, surprised, and maybe even once in a while, if we allow it, changed. As George Clinton used to say, think. It ain't illegal yet. If you write an opinion column, that's supposed to be your mission statement, the highest expression of what it is that we do. Not this stale predictability that too often passes for commentary, that tries to make up in sheer volume and nastiness what it lacks in thoughtfulness and coherence. I'm sorry, but I have trouble seeing the usefulness in that. I mean, think about it. If you already know what Ann Coulter is going to say, what do you need Ann Coulter for? Thank you. I'm told we have time for a few questions and answers. Probably work better if you do the questions and then I'll try to do the answers. Yes, sir.
How are we supposed to hold you accountable?
You're supposed to hold us accountable by writing letters. People tend not to understand their power. People tend not to understand how seriously we take when we hear from our readers, especially from readers who are able to thoughtfully critique what it is that we've done. So when I say this, I don't mean it as a brush off. Write a letter to the editor. Let the editor know, this I like this. This I do not like. Okay? As somebody who gets about 1,000 emails a week, and I'm not able to answer them all, but the ones I almost invariably answer are the ones that have a thoughtful critique of what I've written. Most of what you get when somebody doesn't like what you've written is they will suggest that your mother and father were never married. Okay? All right, that's 9 out of 10 of the critical letters that you get. What I like is somebody who can, as I said, grapple with me. You know, I like, you know, the best friend that we have in this business is an informed reader, is an informed viewer, who can talk about our biases. I mean, my company alone spends I don't know how many millions of dollars with focus groups and public opinion surveys trying to figure out what you think. You know, so if as a reader you are more proactive in saying this works, you know, I like this, this I didn't like, you get a hearing. You know, crazy people don't get hearings. Don't get me wrong. You know, there's a circular file I keep at the side of my desk for them. But people who are thoughtful, even in critiquing, even in negativity, they get a hearing. They will get a hearing. Yes?
Is there a way to solve this problem of the dueling truths?
Is there a way of solving this problem of dueling truths? I don't know. You got one? Because, see, part of the issue with dueling truths, as in we have two different versions of what is true, part of the problem is that, you know, this new invention called the Internet. And people have this, you know, first of all, there's this sense that corporate-controlled media are not telling you the truth, okay? Now, there is some validity to being concerned about corporate-controlled media because if more and more companies, if fewer and fewer companies own more and more news media, then you have fewer voices there, okay? So there is some truth to that. But what you get instead of that sort of, you know, nuanced look at it is sort of this... people seem to have this vision that, you know, I've got a gun to my head telling me what it is that I can say or what I can't say. And no one has yet, in 14 years of doing this, 14 years at the Herald, 29 years overall of doing this, come up to me and say, you can't say that. You can't argue that. So it doesn't work quite the way people think that it does. My point being that because they feel like they're not getting the truth from us, people are going to other sources. People are going to the Internet in particular. The problem with the Internet is that it is, you know, it is not vetted. There's no gatekeeper function, I guess. All facts are created equal, okay? And you have to be very careful of believing stuff that you read on the net. People tend to feel like because it's not vetted, there's no reporter involved in this, there's no editor involved in this, it's got to be true. You know, and it could be just some guy in his bathrobe sitting in his mother's basement, you know? And often is some guy in his bathrobe sitting in his mother's basement, you know, typing stuff up. What I tell people often is to look for opinions, particularly in terms of punditry, look for opinions that disagree with yours and test yours against them. You know, have an open enough mind to test your opinion against whatever it is that somebody else is saying. You know, that's how you can determine, you know, one, if you're on track or if you're able to defend what it is that you're saying. And by having access to more than one more than one media strain, you can have reasonable assurance that you're getting the truth. In other words, if you're just trusting the daily paper, then, you know, maybe you're getting something filtered. If you're trusting your daily paper and you've got another paper, or you've got a broadcast news source, or heck, with the Internet, you've got an international news source, maybe you're getting a different slant on the news. As the Internet has been bad for us in the sense that it's democratized the news and made all facts to be created equal, it's good in the sense that if you don't like the spin that you're getting from the American news sources, there are other reputable news sources worldwide that you can go to. You can go to the BBC with a couple of clicks and get a different slant on the story. And maybe between the two of those, you will get something approaching the truth. Yes? I like NPR. I don't believe in unbiased news sources. I think everybody's biased. I think that... I think they're a reliable news source. I think the whole idea of I'm going to find an unbiased news source is kind of searching for the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant or something like that. It's not going to happen. What you're looking for is a news source that seeks to be fair. We are all biased in some way or another. We all came from someplace. We all have one of two genders. We all have, you know, we are all of certain age. We're all, you know, certain cultural background, et cetera, et cetera. So we're all shaped by those things. What you're looking for is reporters and news outlets that are willing to make it a mission to bring in voices from outside of that, you know, to bring in opposing voices, to balance whatever it is that's being said. But yeah, I think NPR is a very good news source. Yes?
As a 1971 journalism school graduate,
okay,
I wanted to ask you to what extent you hold responsible those schools that are training journalists, editors, and commentators.
I don't know if it's the school. It's the schools, I guess, but I think it's also the marketplace. I think it's also this thing of, you know, I was on a panel just this morning, and veteran journalist was talking about the fact that in our business now we are required, they're increasingly asking us to get 30% profit margins. You know, it used to be an 8 to 10% profit margin, and now they're looking at for a 30% profit margin. And when you're looking for a 30% profit margin, you know, who knows what will happen. There is a newspaper that I wrote about in, it's in South America, I forget which nation, but they have this thing where readers can vote on the news. Readers can vote on what is covered. The headline for my for the column that they did for me was, "You decide, we'll report." And the way it, and the way it works, and see, this scares me because I can see it in this country. The way it works, they're facing the same thing we're facing here, is declining interest from their readers. So they do a story, and it's on their website, and depending on how many clicks it gets, how many votes, that's the story that gets followed up. And in the week that I wrote about this, the story that got followed up was something about nude waitresses or something along those lines, you know. But there was also an economic summit in town, but we don't want to hear about, you know, we don't want to hear about that. Sir? The question is, do I do what I do as a columnist in order to appeal to a broader cross-section of people, meaning that I don't tend to write a lot of hard policy and politics stuff. Yes, there is that. There's also the fact that, you know, what I write is represents where my interests are. As a columnist, you can't write, I can't write because a matter, because an issue is important or because an issue is in the news. I've got to write stuff that I care about, stuff that I care enough about to invest the time to do 19.61 inches. Twice a week. Yeah, you know I got that figure tattooed on my brain. I got to make my 19.61 inches twice a week, so it has to be something that that means something to me, something that I care about. I found myself writing about Washington a lot more now because of the debacle, you know, that we've been in the last few years, and I found myself writing a lot about Washington a few years ago when the former president had his zipper malfunctions. But other than that, I really don't do a lot of writing about Washington and about, you know, the, you know, international politics. I like writing about social and political issues. I call it, you know, water cooler stuff, or, you know, supermarket checkout line stuff, the things that people are actually are talking about, the everyday people are talking about. That's the stuff that resonates the most with me. Sir?
You mentioned our fascination with star power. You winning Pulitzer Prize, how has that positively or negatively affected your work in your life?
Well, you get a lot more attention when you write the Pulitzer Prize, and you know, it's there's a joke among journalists that when you win the Pulitzer Prize, you know two things. You know that you will have an obituary in the New York Times, and you know what the first line will be: Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so that's cool. You know, the acclaim that comes with that is nice. But for me as a journalist, now I don't know if there are any writers in the room, but for me as a writer, discontent is my best friend. And I'm not talking about discontent with issues. I'm talking about discontent with my own work, feeling that there's always a way to get better. So in that sense, a Pulitzer Prize or any other award is a little bit scary, you know, because there's a temptation to rest on your laurels. It's a temptation to say, okay, I'm good enough now. And I tell my students all the time, the moment you say you're good enough, you're not good enough. You know, so I tend to take it with a grain of salt, the Pulitzer. Dave Barry had a line when he won his Pulitzer. He wrote a column that said it represented the overwhelming drug problem in this country, that somebody was willing to give him a Pulitzer Prize. and I tend to kind of look at mine a little bit like that also. I think you have to, you know, you appreciate it. You enjoy what it's given to your life, but you also have to kind of take it with a bit of a grain of salt, because if you take it too seriously, then I think you have there's a danger that you can sort of rest on those laurels and you're not the writer that you're trying to be.
You've got some questions.
Oh, I'm just completely ignoring the side of the room, aren't I? Yes, ma'am. Actually, you'd have a hard time keeping that from happening, to be perfectly honest with you. The thing that you know, editors like when you like their columnists, but even better is that you respond. Okay, so response is a validation. You know, when you object to a columnist, if you're objecting to their point of view, then you're probably not, and your goal is to see that this columnist is no longer on the pages of the paper. That argument's probably not going to get you very far because, you know, people object to everybody's point of view. And that is the idea. The kiss of death for a columnist is that nobody's reading and nobody's responding. But if people are responding even to say that idiot is wrong, then the columnist is doing his job. You will get further with an editor if you say, you know, the issue is not that I disagree with her point of view, it's that I think she's mean, or that I think she's unfair, or that I think she's, you know, not well thought through. You might get a little further there. But again, even at that, I mean it's an inexact science. But I do know when I talk to editors all the time, my first question is not do they like me when they say we're running your column. My question is not do they like me, do they hate me, it's are they responding? You know, our readers responding, and as long as readers are responding, then as a columnist, you're doing your job. The problem is, as I said, there's a way to get people to respond because you've been thoughtful, and then there's a way to get people to respond because you're willing to say something asinine. And Mona Charon is, you know, takes the latter road. Yeah. Any other questions from over here? So I thought they ignored this side somewhere. Okay. Yes. If I ask a child, how do I know if I'm getting their opinion? I don't know. I've never asked a child. Want me to ask you?
My parents don't influence me anyway. She doesn't yell at me. She just tells me her opinion.
Okay. Boy, you just invited me to step all in some stuff. I don't know quite how to answer that because I've never really spent a lot of time asking, you know, young people for their opinions. I do know that, and I'm talking about people now a little bit older than you, my college students, I do know that young people tend to be very earnest in their opinions, and they tend to be very, at your age, you are often discovering injustice for the very first time, and you are very passionate about it, and in some ways that's a good thing because you have more energy and are more willing to not accept the okey-doke than people my age. In some ways, it's a bad thing because it can sort of make you, you know, go off the deep end. So, you know, I respect, and I say this in all honesty, I respect the passion that I sense in you for the issues, but if and when you're ever, you know, about to go off the deep end, I hope that your parents have enough influence on you to kind of pull you back a little bit. Okay? Sir? People have not a clue. The question is, do I think that most people know that the airwaves are owned by the public? No, people have not a clue. For those who don't know, the broadcast airwaves, as opposed to the cable broadcasting, broadcast airwaves are publicly owned and are licensed for the use of CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, et cetera, by the FCC. And they have to, in order to maintain their license, they have to show that they are acting in the public interest, if I'm not mistaken, is the language. And no, I don't think we often hold them accountable. Matter of fact, broadcast news is probably more susceptible to pressure by upset consumers than most other forms of news media, because if you put enough complaints in with the FCC that you don't like this, that, or the other, you feel that they're biased in some way or that they're not being fair, then that affects their ability to get relicensed from, I don't know if it's year to year or every however often it is that they have to go to be relicensed. Yes.
I really enjoy your column because you're a big writer.
Thank you.
Two related things. First of all, I was wondering if you could just mention maybe a couple of your favorite writers that you like to read, not journalists, but just writers.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Miami Herald has Eve Carl Madison and Jake Berry. Mm-hmm. They're all, you know, great writers. It's sort of a social
I ain't going there. One, because the AJC runs my column, and two, because I've got a good friend on the op-ed page of the AJC, so I'm not even going to touch that. The Herald has always had a reputation as a writer's paper. I don't think, frankly, we do as much as we should now to really deserve that reputation. But when I came there, very much had a reputation as a writer's paper, and I think you see that reflected not just in our columnists, but also in some of our, you're probably not as familiar with our reporters because their work wouldn't get as widely disseminated, but we have some reporters who can flat out write. You know, there's a guy named Marty Mercer, who's just brilliant. We had a guy, he just died not too long ago, named John Dorschner. Wrote a piece for our Sunday magazine when we still had a Sunday magazine that brought tears to people's eyes. So yeah, we've got some pretty strong writing talent, or heritage, I should say, pretty strong writing talent. As for who are my favorite writers, well, that's, you know, I'm a pretty promiscuous reader, so that list is kind of all over the place. I read Dave Barry, the writer who had the most influence on me. I started considering myself a writer when I was 5 years old. That's when I decided this is what I wanted to do with my life. So the writer that had the most influence on me initially was Stan Lee, and then Beverly Cleary, and let's see, what's the other children's book author? You know, these are the folks that I studied from, that I learned my craft from. Then you got Larry McMurtry, who I just think is brilliant. The writers that I like now are writers that, you know, my judgment of whether a writer's doing any good is if he or she makes me jealous. Okay, Larry McMurtry makes me jealous. Stephen King I hate because he's so good. You know? He is just, and it's not even about, I'm not necessarily a fan of horror. I mean, it doesn't matter to me, but he can do more in a paragraph than most writers can do in two or three pages of just characterization and setting the mood and everything. So, you know, those are some of the folks, you know, that I read. There's probably a lot more. I know there's a lot more. Yes.
You want to talk a little bit about your fiction writing, how that's going, what you're writing about?
my fiction writing is a work in progress. I'm on chapter 7, and I'm doing about 1,000 words a day when I'm not traveling. What else do you want to know about my fiction writing? You know, it's kind of hard to talk about it because it's not, you know, it's still in progress.
I used to be a reporter. It seemed like everybody else besides me always had a novel.
So what's wrong with you? Yeah, no, I definitely aspire to that. But, you know, on the other hand, as I was telling my editor, actually a friend of mine, the other day, I've only ever had three career goals, and I've already hit two of them. I wanted to be successful as a columnist, and I wanted to teach at the college level. So maybe there's a reason. The third was fiction. So maybe there's a reason I haven't published that book yet, because then, you know, what do I have to live for? So maybe I either need to get a new goal or just not publish for a while. I don't know. Way in the back. Yes, sir. You commute from Tennessee?
I come back here for the weekend for programs like this.
Okay.
And recently I did a Tennessee where I started by people memorizing Bible verses. It's kind of interesting. When I cross the line, it seems like Michael Savage comes on. I don't know if you know Michael Savage.
Talk show host.
His name reflects his radio commentary.
Okay. He called Bush a liberal. Yeah, I don't know. Talk radio is a whole other land to me. And God bless you if you can listen to it. I really cannot, because I just get a headache and my blood pressure goes up. And, you know, you start screaming at the radio, which is not, you know, just not a good thing. So I really cannot deal with that medium. Yes, sir. You said the civil rights era and the Motown era? Okay. All right.
I found myself, I think people have more in common than not in common. And I found myself
I can't answer for them, but I'll put it to a vote then. The gentleman's question was wanted to know essentially what it is that drew most of you out, whether it was because you feel an affinity, I guess, for my writing and my point of view, or whether it was because you have an interest in issues of journalism that were raised. Is that correct?
Yes.
Sir? Okay, well, we'll put it to a vote then. I'm sorry? You got to have another? Okay, we'll have and another. Okay, folks who came out because of affinity for journalism? Okay. One, two, there you go. Okay, folks who came out because they're readers of mine? Okay. Other? Selling books. Okay. All right. Yes, ma'am.
With all the writing that's gone on for so many years and the action groups like Move On,
right,
Henry Waxman and Common Cause and all those, why hasn't anybody influenced this country?
Oh, I don't know that it hasn't been influenced. Influenced in the direction that you would like, but I think it's definitely being influenced. The question is what kind of influence and what's being done with that influence. But I think the country has definitely been influenced, not necessarily in a good way. I am particularly troubled myself, for instance, by the fact or by the way that we keep being given this red flag of gay marriage to sort of, you know, keep us from looking at all the other things that we ought to be looking at. You know, we're sort of given this issue, you know, sort of like the flag before the bull. That's nothing but influence. I just don't think it's a very, you know, positive influence in the life of our country. You got a hand up, ma'am?
Yeah. I just got an email from somebody who called it to me, Barbara Boxer, who was very much against drilling in Alaska. And
right.
She has an organization, and would I please do this? And of course, I answered it. And then she wanted us to write to all these senators, and they did all the work.
Well, I mean, it's a democracy. The Senate vote was, I think, 51-49. You know, the fact is, we don't always win.
Yeah, well,
you know, right. we don't always win.
Do you think the public outcry? I mean, it's not like when they come out on the streets in Lebanon. I mean, that isn't what you mean. But I mean, do you think public outcry really makes an impact?
Yeah, I think public outcry. Are you talking about with media or with the politicians? With media, yeah, I think public outcry makes an influence. With politicians, with basically every politician I can name except George W. Bush, I think it makes an influence. With Bush, I think it's a whole different animal. I think Bush has a unique ability to see what he wants to see. And I think that, you know, in that regard, the ability of the public to influence him is sadly mistaken. Bush is the only guy I could have known, I can think of, who could have come out of the 2000 election, if you accept the results of the 2000 election, with a victory margin of what, 2, 3, 4 or something like that, and think he had a mandate. You know, I mean, you've got to give the man credit for, I don't know if it's stubbornness, whatever it is, but he's got it. You know, he's got it in spades. He has a great ability not to see or not to hear what he doesn't want to see and what he doesn't want to hear. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's...
Why don't we do one more question, because I want to have time for you to sign some books here.
Okay, well, we'll do this gentleman back here.
I know you must be getting a little worried about now, but would you give us a little bit about your background before
you were born? Where was I? A little bit of background. I was born in Orange, California. Which is just south of Los Angeles. I went to L.A. when I was not, well, my parents went to L.A. when I was 9 months old. They took me along. I'm sorry, I was really about to misstate that. I went to L.A. at 9 months. I grew up in L.A. I was a product of, I lived in South Central L.A., was a product of Los Angeles City Schools, went to the University of Southern California, graduated there when I was 19 years old. I went to work for Soul Magazine, which is a Black entertainment tabloid, spent the next 18 years as a entertainment writer, pop music critic for various publications and for radio and a lot of freelance work. was a writer for Casey Kasem when he had his Casey's Top 40 program. Joined the Miami Herald as its pop music writer in 1991. By 1994, pop music had changed. I had started out with Gladys Knight and the Pips, "You're the Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me." And I was ending up with Snoop Dogg rolling down the street, smoking Indos, sipping on gin and juice. And I said, you know, it's time for me to get out of here. And that's when I started the column that I do now, that I'm doing now. I went to my editor and asked him for, you know, told him I wanted to try a different assignment. I was actually had some great fear about that because he's hired me to do one job, and I'm saying I don't want to do that job anymore. But they agreed, and they allowed me to do this column, and I've been doing it since 94. It became syndicated in 97, I believe it is, and now runs in about 200 newspapers. So that's me.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.